It is Monday, May the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, could North Korea's latest missile launch end peace possibilities with South Korea?
No, I think President Moon Jae-in wants to get back to it, but Kim Jong-un has got to let him. Moon Jae-in, with the South Korean populace, the broader populace that he now serves as president, has to be responsive to bad actions by North Korea.
Also ahead, President Trump speaking to Muslim leaders, the latest on the Trump-Russia probe, plus a new film starring Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. We begin with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's response to North Korea's latest missile launch.
北朝鮮が国際社会の強い警告にもかかわらず
Abe spoke to reporters in Tokyo late on Sunday after holding a National Security Council meeting in response to the test. He expressed his hope to discuss the issue at the upcoming Group of Seven, that's the G7 meeting in Italy, and for the international community to send a clear message to North Korea. The North Korean news agency said Sunday's missile launch verified the reliability and accuracy of solid fuel engine operation. Some observers believe the frequent testing of missiles is the North's way of determining the viability of both solid fuel and liquid fuel use. VOA's Victor Beatty asked RAND Corporation international defense scholar Bruce Bennett for his read on this idea.
What we don't know is that they've been talking about doing an ICBM test this year. It appears that the missile tested last weekend was the first stage of the ICBM. The one tested this weekend may well be the second stage. It could be a mixed liquid fuel, solid fuel combination. So I think they're trying to make progress towards accomplishing the ICBM, as Kim Jong-un said in his New Year's address. And that's worrisome because they do seem to be making progress.
On Monday, North Korea said it had successfully tested an intermediate-range ballistic missile to confirm the reliability of a late-stage guidance of the nuclear warhead. What does that mean?
Well, they're looking to try and develop not only a missile that can deliver a warhead, but deliver it relatively accurately. From what I've heard from some former senior defectors, they apparently have been using some form of GPS, potentially U.S. and Russian and maybe Chinese, in their programs. But to make that work, they've got to put together a system that exploits both the location information and guidance. And they're at least claiming that they're getting there. We don't know for sure that that's the case.
Well, Bruce, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on the political fallout said economic and diplomatic pressure will continue on the North. Quote, the ongoing testing is disappointing, disturbing, and we ask that it cease. The Foreign Ministry Office in South Korea said the tests were, quote, reckless and irresponsible, throwing cold water over hopes and desires of the new government of Moon Jae-in and the International Community for Denuclearization and peace on the Korean Peninsula. Is the peace effort over before it even begins as far as South Korea is concerned?
No, I think President Moon Jae-in wants to get back to it, but Kim Jong-un has got to let him. Moon Jae-in, with the South Korean populace, the broader populace that he now serves as president, has to be responsive to bad actions by North Korea. And these continuing missile launches constrain him in his ability to reconcile with the North. The North's got to cut it out, or he's not going to be able to make the progress he would like to.
Secretary Tillerson warned on Sunday the U.S. was still in the early stages of applying pressure on Pyongyang. Does this suggest that the U.S. policy will continue unchanged?
Well, I think actually it'll probably become more stressful on North Korea. I think there are several things that the administration hasn't done yet that they could yet do, and presumably they will do because North Korea continues its bad behavior.
What might those things be, sir?
I think President Trump could well announce that North Korea has claimed that it can put a nuclear weapon on any of its missiles, If that's the case, he may need to put U.S. missile defense ships into the Sea of Japan where they can defend against any missile tests, because North Korea could well launch a missile out over the Sea of Japan and detonate a nuclear weapon on it to claim that it's a nuclear power. And if it does that, it could shoot down airliners, it could sink ships. That's not something the U.S. would want to have happen. So the U.S. may need to take some pretty strong action to prevent that.
Bruce Bennett is a senior international defense researcher at RAND Corporation. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. UN diplomats are saying the Security Council will hold urgent consultations on this latest North Korea missile test. The closed session was requested by the United States, Japan, and South Korea and will be taking place on Tuesday. The diplomats spoke on condition of anonymity because the meeting has not been officially announced. This is VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the significance of Africa Day. Africa Day commemorates the creation of the Organization of African Unity on May 25, 1963. The historical and cultural meaning of Africa Day.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump is several days into a nine-day foreign trip, his first since taking office in January. He began his tour in Saudi Arabia, where he and King Salman signed a nearly $110 billion agreement to bolster the military capabilities of Saudi Arabia. Mr. Trump also addressed a gathering of dozens of Arab and Muslim leaders at a regional summit in Riyadh.
This is not a battle between different faiths, different sects, or different civilizations. This is a battle between barbaric criminals who seek to obliterate human life and decent people, all in the name of religion. People that want to protect life and want to protect their religion. This is a battle between good and evil.
President Trump, who is seeking to ban Muslims from six majority Muslim countries from entering the U.S., did not use the phrase radical Islamic terrorism as he frequently has in U.S. speeches. Instead, he called on the Muslim leaders to honestly confront what he called the crisis of Islamist extremism and the Islamist terror groups it inspires. Reaction to the speech has been mixed, but generally praises have come from many circles, including Muslims. Menaz Afridi is a Muslim, an assistant professor, as well as director of Religious Studies, Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center. That's at Manhattan College. She speaks now with International Edition's Lori London.
Oh, it wasn't really about Islam, but it was about extremism. I just talked to people back home. They thought it was a very good speech, but it wasn't him. They were kind of surprised by him talking about, you know, young Muslim people should have what they want, whereas in his campaign he was totally anti-Islam and Saudi Arabia as well. But there was a whole kind of different Trump, and it was really about we have to squash extremism and the countries have to do it, that the United States was not going to go in and do anything about it.
Do you think there were expectations?
I think the expectations were, you know, very, very low, and I think he did a really good job in terms of the expectations. But, you know, it was all scripted, because if you listen to Trump, he really basically says, you know, we want a radical Islam. He did not use that term at all during his speech. And what he was talking about was talking as if Islam was a valid religion, finally, which is great to hear, and that it was a civilization at some point. But at the same time, he was saying that, you know, you have to squash extremism, this extremism within your own countries, in your own context. We're not here to tell you what to do. So I thought there was, you know, two kind of Trump speaking, at this point. So, and there was 50 head of states, Muslim countries. They were sitting there completely, I think, amazed at this speech that he made because it had nothing to do with Islam. It didn't talk about the faith. It didn't talk about the idea that we are really Muslim people and what we believe in. But he talked about these three great faiths, including Islam. But at the same time, he was just squashing the whole idea that he banned Muslims from coming into this country. But he did not talk about Saudi Arabia. And before he was elected, he made fun of former Senator Clinton about taking Saudi Arabian money for a Clinton initiative. So I'm confused as an intellectual and a scholar, is where is this presidency really going? And the idea that he's going to create more jobs because of his alliance with Saudi Arabia also kind of bites us in a sense, because Saudi Arabia is really, really, really problematic in terms of human rights. So when you talk about democracy or giving young people any kind of opportunity, you have to really address what's going on in the country and the people.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. He made a remark that he was not there to lecture the Muslim countries and to tell them, you know, basically how to live their lives, what to do. Do you think that that was basically, we're not going to get involved with your human rights issues?
I think that was a nod to that, but it was also a nod to the fact that, you know, he's been so critical of the past administration. I think he's saying that, you know, we are going to do things differently. And he kept saying that. And towards the end, he said that. And he dismisses the fact that in Saudi Arabia, you have very low human rights. I mean, in Iran, you do too. But Iran has been a pariah for him. And I believe it's been a pariah because he thinks that the last administration made the worst deal with Iran. If you look at what's going on in the Muslim world, he doesn't address really the Syrian refugee crisis. He addressed Syria once, and he doesn't address why that's a problem or what's going on with Assad. I mean, he doesn't even mention that. And I think that's the problem. I mean, he's not talking about what Europeans are doing or the brunt of these, you know, refugees are coming in. He's just basically saying, oh, we want to eradicate extremism. And the other aspect of this is it's all top-down, right? So we're hanging out with Sheikh Salman, and you are in a milieu that's very different from the people. And there he is. He's getting a medal from the Sheikh. And at the same time, he's not really addressing what's happening to women, what's happening to minorities, what's happening to gay people in that country. They just said, okay, now a woman can finally step out of the house without permission.
I believe Saudi Arabia was on a list, the 11 countries with the worst human rights policies violations. Do you think that being the United States, it's sort of a part of who we are to not just say, oh, well, you do your thing?
You talk about Saudi Arabia being on the list of the worst human rights problems. I mean, the UN just voted them to be on the Human Rights Commission as if they were the pioneer of human rights. I think, honestly, it has to do with money. We should call them out. You know, as we talk about democracy and freedom, and actually Trump did not mention freedom that much, but he talked about democracy and talking about rights for people. This is what, you know, it means to be a global leader. It means to be somebody who steps up and says, hey, you know what? I'm here. Okay, we can even make a deal. But this is what I need to talk to you about. And I think that's the most important thing we can do as a democracy in the United States. And if we're going to be the pioneer of democracy, then we need to call people out. And I think that is something that Trump is not doing.
Benaz Afridi is an assistant professor and director of religious studies, Holocaust, genocide, and the Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. She also is author of the book Shoah Through Muslim Eyes. She was speaking with my colleague Lori London. Saudi King Salman has praised President Trump for his pledge to be tougher on Saudi rival Iran than his predecessor, President Obama. Mr. Trump has said that the king and they agree on the threat that Iran poses to the region when they address their fellow leaders at that gathering in Riyadh. President Trump accused Iran of what he called destruction and chaos, and the king said its rival has been the spearhead of global terrorism. We asked Indiana University scholar Hussein Banai, who specializes in Iran's political development, as well as U.S.-Iran relations, just how this might play in Tehran.
Not well. I think the foreign minister, the Iranian foreign minister, already tweeted right after that, basically mocking Trump making such allegations on Saudi Arabian soil, which has contributed both allegedly financial and armaments to transnational jihadists all over the Middle East, and of course has harbored many of them as well. The Iranian government has always viewed Saudi Arabia as really being the ringleader behind this kind of characterization. So the fact that Trump was making this speech in Saudi Arabia at a conference where other heads of Muslim countries were present, but Iran was deliberately not invited, was seen as basically a nod to a change of policy from the Obama era to something else.
Hussein Banai is a professor at Indiana University, Bloomington. While President Trump is focused on his five-nation foreign trip, back home the news talk shows have been dominated by discussion of his firing of FBI Chief James Comey and investigations into Trump campaign links to Russia. Two key Trump officials, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, told interviewers at a May 10th White House meeting with two Russian diplomats, Mr. Trump brought up Comey's ouster the day before in an effort to show how distracted he had been by Comey's investigation of possible Trump campaign collusion with Moscow and their interest to help him win the election. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman discusses all of this and the latest developments with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
President Trump may be engaged in a whirlwind first big trip abroad as president, but there are a lot of questions that continue to bubble here in Washington. A lot of developments. I mean, now there is a special counsel, the former FBI Director Robert Mueller, who is specially empowered to lead this probe and will have access to a great many people, a great many documents, presumably, all in search of what exactly transpired during the campaign and what has transpired since. And there are people asking whether there has been some sort of cover-up. There are all these reports that have come out suggesting that maybe President Trump told the Russian foreign minister and the ambassador that the pressure was going to be off the Russia probe now that he had fired James Comey, someone he described reportedly in this meeting as a nut job. There are so many elements coming out to this story now that as a poor reporter, one hardly knows where to begin anymore.
You know, the financial markets are often an interesting barometer of public sentiment. On Wednesday, when a lot of this news broke, the markets plummeted and then came back as we heard that Mueller was going to be looking into this and that we would hear from James Comey. It was kind of interesting to see the sentiment turn around as some analysts said, well, if it led to a President Pence, how bad could that be?
This leads to a larger question, though, and I do think that the markets are very sensitive to this sort of question right below the surface. Does that mean that this Republican agenda, which was ambitious to begin with, which was not going to be an easy lift under the most optimistic of circumstances, to what extent does that agenda become more difficult to enact? The markets did rally right after the election quite ferociously on the expectation that a Trump administration would bring a batch of tax cuts and tax reforms and a whole host of things that were deemed to be business friendly. No one's saying that there will be no tax reform. However, the hill to enact these things becomes considerably steeper when you have an embattled president and when you have a Congress that is focused on an investigation rather than on legislating.
And many have never seen a White House have so many leaks.
Well, this is the interesting thing. There's sort of a dichotomy when it comes to the reaction that you see. From Democrats, whenever there is a leak that seems to be something shocking, Democrats are very eager to point to the actual information, whereas Republicans tend to be the ones saying, well, yes, this is unfortunate, but what about the leak? Shouldn't there be an investigation into the leak? How is it that so much of this is coming to light? I will say that Donald Trump is not the first president to have some degree of frustration by the extent to which things that were said in confidence behind closed doors in a private or classified setting do come to light in the public eye. But the sheer volume of leaks and the regularity with which things are given to reporters, it means one of two things. Either reporters have gotten much better at their jobs and ferreting out this information, or there are a number of people in high places who feel a sense of duty to divulge this. And it may speak to the gravity of the situation confronting not just this administration, but the nation as a whole by extension.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman in a great spot to watch all of it and share it with us each week. Michael, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Indeed, and it's a pleasure for us to have you on the program. Thank you very much, gentlemen. You know, you can follow my colleagues on Twitter. Michael Bowman can be found at mbowman, VOA, and Jim Stevenson at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two Canadian researchers say they have constructed a composite image of dark matter filaments that make up what cosmologists call the cosmic web. Scientists have been finding evidence that our universe may be anything but random and that everything is actually organized and connected to each other like an enormous spider web. The researchers from the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, used a special technique called weak gravitational lensing to make their findings. After gathering a number of gravitational lensed images of more than 23,000 galaxy pairs, the scientists were able to create a composite image they say shows the presence of dark matter between the galaxy pairs. The Canadian duo found that the dark matter filament bridges are strongest between galaxy systems that are less than 40 million light years apart. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Oscar winners Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson, along with comedians Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler, star in a new comedy from director Noah Baumbach. It's called The Meyerowitz Stories. And as VOA's David Byrd tells us now, the stories look at the relationship between adult men and their fathers and is competing for the top award at the Cannes Film Festival.
Adam Sandler is earning high praise for his dramatic turn as Danny Meyerowitz in The Meyerowitz Stories. Sandler plays a stay-at-home dad who never quite had the success his demanding father Harold, a mediocre sculptor played by Dustin Hoffman, expected. Danny's marriage is ending, his daughter is leaving home for college, and he lives in the shadow of his successful half-brother Matthew, played by Ben Stiller. Matthew lives in Los Angeles and constantly refers to Danny and his sister Jean, portrayed by Elizabeth Marvel, as his half-brother and sister to emphasize their separation. But the siblings are thrown together when their father is hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage. The siblings argue over whether to sell Harold's Manhattan apartment, work together to stage a retrospective of his work at Bard College, where he was once on the faculty, and try to come to some sense of reconciliation. The film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, where director Noah Baumbach said the comedic drama gave him a chance to explore ideas he had for years.
In various ways, in my movies, I'm interested in sort of the gap between who we think we are and or who we want to be and who we are, and how far that gap is. And obviously success and professional success and fame and, you know, and the arts is a kind of way to explore that.
Dustin Hoffman said that Baumbach has a way of bringing out the best performances from his cast, both through his comedic timing and his dramatic sensitivity.
He's quite expert. He really is the best. And we do say his dialogue word for word, whether we like it or not. And I think not since The Graduate was I required to say every single word. And it pays off because there is a music to his writing. I agree with Ben. He is a singular artist.
British Oscar winner Emma Thompson stars as Hoffman's third wife, Maureen, an alcoholic who wears tie-dyes and peace beads. Thompson said she had no real emotional frame of reference playing someone embroiled in such a dysfunctional family.
I read it and thought, I have absolutely no idea what this is going to be like. I know it's going to be fascinating, but I had no idea at all. And then I thought, oh, I've got to play an American, which is quite hard, and I've got to play an alcoholic, which isn't hard at all. So that was the thing probably that attracted me most, because I thought, well, I'll be able to relax about playing the American, because being drunk will make it so much easier.
Adam Sandler has earned many positive reviews for his portrayal of Danny, proof that he can deliver a strong dramatic performance when he is asked to. Sandler said that he wanted to give his best because of the caliber of people he was working with.
It's different for a comedian when you get an offer like this. And my first thought is I don't want to let anybody down. And I work as hard as I can to make sure I know the material and just try to be as good as I can be.
The Meyerowitz Stories is one of two Netflix entries at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Beginning next year, all films will have to have been released in French cinemas if they want to be considered for the Golden Palm. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Many thanks to you, Dave. Well, a judge has confirmed that singer-songwriter Prince's six siblings will be his rightful heirs, bringing them a step closer to collecting the shares of the music legend's multi-million-dollar estate. More than 45 people came forward in the wake of Prince's death, claiming to be his wife, his children, his siblings, and other relatives. Prince died on April the 21st of last year of an accidental overdose of a drug called fentanyl. It's a synthetic drug 50 times more powerful than heroin. Since his death, Prince's Paisley Park studio complex and home have been turned into a museum and a concert venue. And this is it. Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus, out of business, final show on Sunday evening after 146 years of wowing audiences all over the world as the greatest show on earth. Bye-bye to Ringling Brothers. And thank you for tuning in to the Voice of America today for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States government is saving lives in the Lake Chad Basin. Today, some 7 million people are suffering from severe hunger in the Lake Chad Basin. Thousands may have already experienced famine. Malnutrition is rampant, and over the past few years, the region has increasingly suffered numerous outbreaks of contagious diseases, such as hepatitis E, meningitis, measles, cholera, and even polio. The United Nations calls the situation a complex humanitarian emergency, a major crisis that is often the result of political instability, conflict and violence, social inequities, and poverty. In the Lake Chad region, one of the main contributors to the crisis is the Boko Haram terrorist group. For 15 years now, Boko Haram has attacked civilians in Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Nigeria, causing instability and conflict. But the crisis is also caused by decades of neglect. A lack of rural development has left many communities vulnerable to extreme weather events, such as floods and drought. Since 1960, Lake Chad has also lost about 90% of its water. That means disaster for people whose livelihood directly depends on the lake, such as fishermen and farmers. And of course, there is a considerable ripple effect as people escaping hunger in one region strain the resources of the areas to which they move. The United States is committed to responding to people affected by this crisis. Working with our partners, we are helping states and communities prepare for disasters and to help people withstand crises. We also provide emergency humanitarian aid. So far in fiscal year 2017, with USAID in the lead, the United States government has provided more than $203 million worth of humanitarian aid to the countries of the Lake Chad Basin. This aid includes food, nutritional supplements, safe drinking water, hygiene kits, and emergency medical services. Yet the need is great and growing, and in the Lake Chad Basin, people are suffering. we urge our partners and all humanitarian donors to increase their level of support during this critical time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.